Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Hello, everyone. I hope we now have already some regular guests of the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. This is the 7th episode, and I'm extremely happy that we have an extremely impressive commodity trader. Today, Stefan Bernard, head of commodity trading of Export Trading Group, ETG. Now, I didn't know Stefan till some of the talented traders that worked on my cocoa trading desk moved to ETG, and then they told me about Stefan. And I looked at his resume and I thought, wow, this is some impressive resume. And what the hell have I done if I look at what Stefan has done? And therefore, I'm so happy because it's a very interesting commodity trader with an impressive career, good in fundamental trading, but also very good in systematic trading. And when we in Cargill in the early 2000s, we're just looking at some funny charts. Stefan was already developing sophisticated systematic trading strategies. So very interesting guest and very happy.
Yeah. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning.
I was indeed just telling to the guys offline that I was last week in Singapore and Kuala Lumpur that you get so much inspired by all the traders and all the trade that has been done in Singapore. But also when you fly in actually from Kuala Lumpur to Singapore, and you look out the window when you start landing in Singapore, you see all these boats outside of the Singapore Harbor. You see all these, I think it's because we discussed this a bit in Singapore, but some are just, I think, lying around as a stock when the price goes up a bit. But it's a super inspiring place for traders. And again, you have been there as well many times. It's just talking to traders, they are everywhere. They are everywhere. And these places where you see that in Singapore where so many people from abroad, expats from all over the world working in the commodity trade. And then there's so little known about this world. I'm so happy we're making this podcast. And I got really cool feedback, some ideas from people in that the traders that they were like, oh, you can ask this person. So it was amazing to be there and amazing to have you on this podcast, Stefan.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, guys. It's a real honor for me. I've listened actually more than once to your previous interview, starting with your Inception interviews and the story of Martijn. And I've heard of Martijn as well through the guys that I've hired, TTG. And I guess our path haven't crossed because our universes were different. But then I was really impressed by Ivo. I interviewed his name. I knew his name, but I never really knew who he was. And that was super impressive. And of course, Dan. And your last gentleman, that for a Frenchman, his first name is impossible to spell. So, with him, I guess we share a common ground in the freight. I was as well a freight trader at Louis Dreyfus for 1.5 years, 2 years. But those people following them, I feel a bit of pressure this morning. I feel probably a bit more stressed out than any position I've been in.
No, but we can start with a very easy question. Why did you become a commodity trader?
I didn't know what commodity trading was when I started. I actually knew I wanted to be a trader. So when I finished my business school, I was doing an internship at Banque Indosuez in France and in the M&A. And back then it was very hype to be in merger acquisition, but I didn't find it really interesting intellectually. And the stairs up were the floor of the Indosuez trading bonds. And I was desperate to get, always going up, any breaks I could go. I was joining those guys. I found that so exciting. I've been a keen reader, and when I was younger, as well, the world, the history, geopolitics, and economy. There were those stories back then in the mid-80s of George Soros. Mm. And it was so amazing to think that a man can be such an important factor in what's going on in the world. And that was really intriguing me. So I thought I want to be a currency trader, bond trader. But then I realized when I was going there on that floor that I didn't have the right education. Back then in France, they were already hiring engineers. And I was, that wasn't my background. And luckily, I was doing relatively well in that internship. And one of the managers was the brother of Laurent Bouvier, who was the CEO of Louis Dreyfus back then in Europe. And they were doing hiring of young people a generation of young traders. And I came in very late in the process, and I was very lucky to, I guess, connect with the people during the interviews. And it was very Louis Dreyfus style back then. And
what is Louis Dreyfus style in the meantime? How does that look like?
It wasn't an organized corporation. It was a very different setup, I guess, than Cargill. It was a place of entrepreneurship, of traders, run by traders. It, compared to today's world, you would say it wasn't corporate, but it was a thriving place of very strong individuals and talented people. And so I had, like, I don't remember, 12, 15 interviews in 2 days. And then the day after, I got a job offer. It was just because I guess we connected at a personal level. And I didn't know anything about Louis Dreyfus, didn't know anything about commodities trading, didn't know that commodities were traded, actually. And it was fascinating. So I was very lucky to start there in Paris and in a very exciting place. And very fast, they actually decided to send me to Hamburg, to the Hamburg office, because I was speaking German. I was the only young guy that was speaking German. And so they sent me. And yeah, I guess that's where the journey started. And what happened during that period certainly explains a lot of how I built myself out as a commodity trader. And I'm not sure I'm an impressive commodity trader, to be honest, but I do think that I am a bit different than usually other commodity traders. And that probably has to see a little bit with my background initially and how I started in the career, being put in a spot. I guess back then, you're talking here the mid-90s, information was still gold back then. The firms like Louis Dreyfus, I'm sure in the energy space, and the metal space and in the art space, for sure, some companies were having an edge due to the access to information that was not accessible to others. And what was the most important, I guess, edge for those big entities were an informational edge. And so there was a bit of tight, information was held tight to the chest in the decision-making centers. And for Louis Dreyfus, that was Wilton in the US and Paris. And if you were in a satellite office, you actually didn't fully have exposure to the balance sheet analysis, which sounds kind of crazy today. Some of the major data drivers, you could not access them. So I was far from the decision-making center. And in Hamburg, we were dealing with intervention grains, was more of a logistic type of play, and a little bit of markets. And I thought, wow, why am I here? I want to be a trader, and this is not trading the way I was thinking. But I realized afterwards how critical it was for my learnings and education to understand logistics and execution. And at the end of the day, we still handle physical stuff. But it wasn't the way I was expecting my trading career.
You said you're a different trader, that's what you're saying. What makes you a different trader than Martijn, do you think, or others?
I think others, when you were starting at Cargill or Louis Dreyfus in the decision-making center, you immediately got exposed to this great know-how of fundamental understanding analysis, the whole process. And when you were in, like me, you were outside of that, I realized that I didn't have this edge. And then I had to work out for myself a way to build an edge for me to understand or have a view on markets, because the access to information was not sufficient, even though all of the offices were participating to it. But for logical reasons, there was a control on the information because that was the major edge for the firm. So I need to have a view on market. So I started to do technical analysis. For at least I don't have the fundamental full overview out of Hamburg. Let with price, I should, and I did with, as everybody else, the usual things, looking at charts and some things that were told were working. And I think I was very lucky because from very early on, I was reading books from the first day at Louis Dreyfus. And back then, it was a challenge getting a trading book in Europe. We didn't have internet. So first to know that they existed and then to order them. And I remember my first ever trading book that I bought was Traders Interviews by Jack Traeger. And this first book of Traders Interviews was just fascinating. Yeah. But I remember it cost me $120 to get it to Paris. That's crazy. When those
Amazon was not really live yet.
It was not. And then I bought this book on technical analysis, one of the Bible, Mr. Murphy's trading analysis, a technical analysis book. But then I thought, that's weird. Why would Head and Shoulder or support, why does it actually work? And I guess all of us traders, we share something in common. We are a bit of contrarian people, right? Almost by definition, I would say. And I thought, as soon as somebody tells me this is what works or this is what you need to do, I have this little monkey in my head that says, let's check out if that assumption is right. So I started coding those things, moving averages, crossovers. In Reuters, back then, there was a language called Metastock, and you could code. And then I said, okay, well, let's test those things. That started in 95, and it took me a long time because that's not my background and to really do it in a good, in a proper way. But I started to have some evidence-based understanding of technical analysis. And that helped me. And then I said, okay, then I was very lucky to come back to Paris a year and a half later on the freight desk. And that was still to today, maybe as a professional, my most enjoyable time ever. For it was
so much fun to be on the freight desk.
It was fantastic. Back then in the dry bulk freight, Louis Dreyfus was one of the main players, actually with Cargill. Cargill and Louis Dreyfus were the biggest players on the global dry bulk freight as a trading desk. It was populated with extremely brilliant people, and I was extremely lucky to be with great mentors there. And freight, and your previous guest was as well mentioning that freight is acts as a commodity, but it's not a commodity, right? But it is probably the commodity with copper that is the most connected to the global economy. What happens in the global economy will always have a direct impact on freight. Yeah. And that was the second piece of what makes me a bit different is I realized back then, on the freight desk, I had access to the S&D of Louis Dreyfus, and we were running analytics and started to learn a bit more the power of fundamental analysis. But in the freight, you cannot disconnect your understanding of the macro. It's not possible. I mean, it's not just ships positioning that will influence freight markets. Freight markets, the short term, yes, but for the trend is set by the supply demand of the need of transport stuff. And that's coming directly from the health of the global economy. And so that's when I started that. So now we're in 98. Then I start saying, hey, I need to understand macroeconomy. If I don't understand macroeconomy, I won't be able to trade freight properly. My charts actually worked really nice on freight. This S&D that Dreyfus has was amazing. And then back then, there was still a very active futures market in freight. There was an organized futures market, the BFEX. And afterwards, that then changed into what freight is today, which is again cleared, but it's a forward rate agreement, right? But then it was a futures market and a non-deliverable futures, which kind of was helping big entities to run very sizable position, right? And I remember us owning up to 70% of open interest for some expiries. And Louis Dreyfus was much more of a trading firm in the sense of, I guess, prop trading than Cargill, for example, back then, or even more ADM or Glencore or Macrich was the name back then. So that we were very active in those markets. And I was leaning into the derivatives because in my whole career, that's why I'm saying as a commodity trader, you know, I've never been really sharp in the physical execution of any contract, to be honest. I remember doing big mistakes and because it's just my brain, I guess, doesn't embrace that. But ask me to have a view on risks, understanding connection between things and where the market can head towards from a strategic perspective. I guess that was my angle. And so that's in that sense I'm different. I think I was in a way obliging myself at least to really get into being an expert on technical analysis. And then over the years, understanding the macro well enough to support my understanding of fundamentals. And then I think that's why it's always been what really excites me in our world, the commodity world. It's that it is the only asset class where you really connect to what the heartbeat of the world. Now, equities markets can act in a very artificial way for many reasons, or bonds as well, currencies as well. But commodities, you're connected to the heartbeat of the world, right? And that is really what I think is super fascinating in commodities.
Thanks. Stefan, I think it's already quite an excellent, I'm listening very carefully to all what you say because you touch base on so many topics. And I'm thinking, wow, we can do a podcast on any of those topics. But to make myself easy and to catch you on, ask you on the very last point, and you also mentioned Evo. And Ivo wrote a fantastic book, one of the best books I read, Commodities as an Asset Class. Yeah. And one of the things was, are commodities a hedge against inflation? And I totally with you that the commodity markets have do reflect the underlying economy. What is interesting now is that if you look at commodity indexes, at the moment, they have gone down, down, down. Yeah. Now, cocoa and gold are exceptions. Yeah. But if you look at the grains, they have been trending down for a long time. We all know that equity markets have been making all-time highs. Now, then you have the debate about, okay, equity markets are not the economy. Other things are there. And then things like speculation, things like the central bank policies, or at least the anticipation of central bank policies at the moment, maybe anticipation of lower rates. Now, how do you see that at the moment? If you look at the clear decline of outside of gold then and cocoa, which is a niche committed commodity, how do you see that current situation, the signal that the opposing signals maybe that the global equity markets and the commodity indexes give?
Well, to answer that question, I think it's good to share my learning as on the macro, applying a mindset of commodity trader was to get a mapping. And I realized that then some much more brilliant people like Ray Dalio and many others were using a similar template. But I came to that conclusion progressively and, well, on my own, but I didn't articulate it as well, I guess, as those brilliant people. But today it helps me to explain, but that's the full process. To answer your question, I think you need to be able to have a template of what is macro. Mm. So macro, in my view, to simplify it, is the ability to understand in which quadrant of the macro environment you are and where are you heading towards. And this quadrant, so four boxes, you can use two variables. And if you get those variables, you will be mostly right in understanding the macro background. And those variables are essentially growth, rate of change of GDP, and rate of change of inflation. So if inflation and GDP both accelerate, you get a reflationary environment. If inflation accelerates but growth slows down, it's a nasty quadrant called stagflationary environment. If both inflation and the growth slow down, you are in a deflationary quadrant. And if growth accelerates and inflation slows down, you are in paradise on earth. It's the Goldilocks environment. Goldilocks. Nobody can lose money except short sellers. Question is, where are we or where have we been and where are we heading towards? So what has made the last year very complex? I haven't had a good year myself. My last year has been a struggle on the trading side. And we can then discuss trading process because I think that's the other thing where I'm very different than other traders. You can have a very bad year and not blow up the house and not lose a big amount of money. So that's another topic. But analytically and intellectually, I got last year really wrong because at the start of last year, I had a very high conviction, like many other people, that we would head towards a deflationary quadrant, which was essentially bearish. So in a deflationary quadrant, you're actually bearish almost every asset class except for bonds. And in some context, gold, depending how you enter into that, and bearish all currencies essentially against the dollar. So bullish, right? So that conviction was very high. And there was some evidence during the year that we were, you know, the market was trading as such. But then there was some contradictions as well during some periods. So between May and end of July, it wasn't acting that way. And then since November, it's not acting that way. Between August and October, it was acting according to that idea. And I got that wrong because last year the US government did something unique, never did, outside of war periods, which is to reflate fiscally without being in a recession. And not only that, but it was a huge fiscal reflation linked to the IRA, and which has added around 30%, give or take, of additional growth and employment backed by the US government. And that has been, of course, the debt, the U.S. debt has exploded in the process by around $1.7 trillion. But it has created a very strong growth background that has sustained by itself enough of global liquidity and world growth to make it this kind of muddle through weird environment in which we have been, which you can see, as you highlighted, Martin, into the price action of copper, of crude oil, grains. I'm not sure grains are linked to macro. We can get back to that, or at least not always, and in different shape and forms. But freight was as well selling off pretty steeply between June and August, September. So yeah, we had this environment that was deflationary, actually, but neutralized by the fiscal policy of the US. And that, so we created this range bound that has been so painful for many commodity traders last year. I know most of energy traders and metals traders haven't had a good year because your fundamentals were looking different. I mean, you could argue for tightness in base metals. You can argue for tightness in base metals, especially with the green transition and for the longer term perspective. But even for energy, you can argue on that. But the reality is that the macro environment was negative. So what does that mean? So what we went after COVID from an extremely reflationary environment to a deflationary. And then now we've been in the middle. So think about those quadrants, and we've been circling and dancing around the middle now for almost 1 year. This is the most difficult environment for a trader to navigate because breakouts don't work, but mean reversion doesn't work necessarily either. The kings of the game are the so-called gamma shorts. So anybody that suppresses volatility and has been selling volatility for 18 months has been looking good, except if they're short volatility on cocoa, on sugar, on cotton, on freight in December. So you have pockets where markets, when they start to overshoot or move, they tend to overshoot. And I think one of the very interesting thing we have is that we have this huge suppression of volatility driven by those very major hedge funds that played this strategy, like the Citadels of this world. And as well, it's been a winning strategy. So many people are running those strategies, but it creates this huge tail risk. And that's, I guess, we can discuss back then. Cocoa, sugar was very interesting. Cotton, again, freight. The way I see the world is, I think we are heading towards a deflationary environment, which is essentially bearish commodity. But there are very still forces around that neutralize partially that path still. But and at the same time, you've created a very extremely over-leveraged debt environment on the public side and government side, linked with a very significant gamma short across the board. So that's one thing. And then just one other small topic, when you say equities did well, two equities did well. Okay, we have the same picture than we had in 99, 2000. The indices, some indices do very well, but they do very well because only a few big leaders pull them up. And actually, until December last year, Russell 2000 was flat or negative. S&P 500, a weighted average index, was flat. And so we are in a cycle. Remember that after COVID, we injected so much liquidity in the global system. There's so much available money that needs to chase returns, that you have bubbly environments in many places. Yeah, I think it's a very complex environment. I must say that I'm not sure yet how to trade it fully.
But you're the head of trading at ETG, so probably there will be some people looking at you like, what are we going to do?
Yeah, so what I think was is very interesting, and we did well this last year in a few commodities. We did well in coffee, we did well in sugar, we did well in cotton. We start to do actually relatively well in grains in all since December, since the bearish trend is taking place and it's been a noisy. We are struggling on the macro side. We are struggling on the business side because of this global environment that is highly complex. But I think we've been there in the past. We are a very senior team of people and we've seen the picture in the past. You have those transition periods and you need to adapt your business to respond to those environments. But at the same time, I must say that I'm super excited. I believe that the next 10 years will be golden years for traders in commodities.
Oof.
Because we've created so many imbalances in terms of supply freight. With the container rally and tankers being very tight, we will be under invested for dry bulkers within a couple of years. We're at current prices, the prices that dry bulk freight have been trading the last 2 years, you will struggle to create enough supply. And those are very long cycles. Copper, if you believe only partially in the transition, and you don't even need to be super confident about that story, you actually know that either we find new technologies to transport electricity, or you have a real issue to address to find enough supply, copper supply, within a couple of years from here. It's not short term, but you're coming to a stage that within a couple of years, except if we have a global big recession, world recession, it will be hard to match this, the supply with coming demand. I think cocoa was a very interesting case, and Martin explained it very well in his first podcast, and I think there are a few other ones. It's multiple years of price discovery being destroyed by an artificial mechanism, leads to underinvestment, leads to undercarrying of trees, etc. You just need a little bit of weather issue, and there was a weather issue, and then you create a very asymmetrical outcome on the supply. Same topic on Robusta coffee. We were in 18 and 19 under cost of production. The market was trading below cost of production in coffee for 2 years, and that has then had impacts on growers taking care of their trees, not maybe in Brazil, but in more marginal producers or less efficient producers, right? And I think overall, that's a story you can see. Now, on the other hand, you have the grain situation, where grains is still a place where you have technological improvement that is ongoing and is fascinating. Last year, the market got excited by the weather conditions in the US, and almost because the crop got the right amount of rain in 1 day or 2 days, the crop was made. And that's the technology of the seed, the technology of farming. It's still the deflationary pressure of farming innovation is so huge, it makes crops very resilient. And so I think what will be very interesting, you can perfectly be a bear in grains and oilseeds, a bull for a while still in cocoa, I guess, a bull in copper long-term and energy. And that's what makes my role very interesting, because at ETG, we trade base metals, we trade energy, we trade freight, we trade macro markets, we trade grains and oilseeds, coffee, cotton, sugar, cocoa. So it's very interesting to see that, yeah, how do we do? Well, I guess what is important is that macro is not driving commodities all the time, and it's not driving all commodities. So even if the macro picture is not clear, it doesn't mean that you cannot find very clear views on specific commodities. And I think that's what we try to do. We have any of our commodity traders is 100 times better trader in that commodity than me. All of them, no exception. So they know what those commodities' micro drivers are. And my job, I guess, is to bring a macro view and understanding when that macro view can really distort the story of the S&D on the commodities.
But why,
and then you have his...
But yeah. Stefan, I was at the palm oil conference in Malaysia, talked to the dairy traders in Singapore. And so everybody is in their mind also with the UDR rules. Of course, what you say, coffee, sugar, 7 commodities that are being chosen. How is that then for you? Because you touch upon multiple commodities, right? So what do you think will be the impact on this one for the world? If you say, well, the next 10 years will be golden years. There are a lot of people that also find the insecurity at the moment very hard to put in basically in your analysis and to make decisions on that.
So when I'm saying golden years, let me clarify, because sometimes young people ask me, what is trading? And to this day, for me, the best definition I came across trading is a definition that Mr. Macmillan, the chairman of Cargill, gave a long time ago. And he said trading is the transformation of uncertainty into a manageable risk. So nobody knows the future, but the role of a trader is to transform what he doesn't know either, but to analytically come to a probabilistic view of path and transform that into a manageable risk. And that definition of trading for me is the most brilliant definition of trading. So what I'm saying golden years, I'm talking about traders. So more uncertainty going forward means more risks and more opportunities. And that doesn't mean golden period, meaning I'm bullish. No, that's not what I want to say. You know, it's what I'm very much on board of Ivo's book. It will be a period where if you are able to navigate commodities, you can create alpha as a commodity trader. Dynamic and proactive management of decision-making commodities will have more value I believe, in the next 10 years than it has had in some periods in recent past, where I remember the period 2014-19, it was a very hard period for commodity firms. Remember, all the companies were scaling down cost structure because we didn't have enough volatility markets. We had an oversupplied world. There was no alpha to be created by traders as such. The value was only in running supply chains and transformation of commodities into end products. I think the world that is coming, the geopolitics, the fact that we probably have changed our global system from Bretton Woods 2 to a new system, a polarized world, the weather patterns changes, the underinvestment in so many commodities, the complexity of regulation that you highlight, creates an environment that uncertainty increases. And if you believe that trading is the transformation of uncertainty into manageable risk, well, it means that higher uncertainty means a higher dispersion in your decision making to come to the right management of the risk. And in that sense, for me, it would be a golden period for the traders. But of course, you have to know how to navigate. And I think if you approach it with a view that is passive or just long only, or this idea that commodities are ahead of inflation, I think you'll get that very wrong.
And that EU part? So the
My part in the firm?
No, so the EUDR, so the European Deforestation Regulation.
So it depends which businesses. We run so many different businesses. We are very different firms than other firms in that sense. We are highly diversified. So the people that run commodities that have an exposure to that, they have each of the business units, they're building their own structure to address it. Yes. But you know, you cannot, it's not a one single fit for all, right? What is at stake for coffee will be different than, for us, for example, we don't trade raw sugars on the physical side. We only trade white sugars. So we are not directly exposed, I guess, to that as sugar is concerned, but we are clearly on coffee. And we are clearly as a firm, as a group, even though we don't run our division, the physical cocoa business, but of course, those our cocoa division on the physical side, they are extremely active on that. So the traders that I have, that were with Martin, they sit with us, but they are on the derivative side, right? So the group has separated. Yeah, we do address it, of course, but at the business level. Each, the head of coffee, he knows way better how to address that topic than the global head of trading.
Clear. The EUDR, a friend of mine texted me earlier last week, that some of the most stringent elements of the EUDR would be delayed. I haven't checked it. But look, the EUDR comes, if you look at cocoa, for example, it's a very interesting time whereby the EUDR is almost like a dark cloud because it may have a huge impact on exchange-licensed cocoa, which may not be usable anymore for European processing. And then this is an example of regulators, I think with noble ideas and good intentions, could create havoc in a commodity which they don't really understand. Now, I know that a lot of people are very busy with that. I really like the conversation, and it is a very good example for aspiring traders of the debate you would have on a trading desk. And sometimes people ask me, okay, what do you do the whole day? And I say, well, I'm reading and I'm talking the whole day on a desk. We would have a conversation like this to make sense out of the global economy, macroeconomy, and then obviously translate it to to the commodity that we trade or the commodities that we trade. And you try to combine macro, intra-commodity S&D, and technicals. That is in essence what you do. And when you are surrounded by smart people who also genuinely are interested to do that, then along the way, together, you come to a certain view. Then it is the next thing is the difficult thing is obviously to translate it into risk into the market. But I find it fascinating the different angles that you take, and there's almost too much to.
Because did you have sometimes, Martijn, did you have sometimes days where you just didn't make any trade, any decision? Because I had sometimes, I called it watching the ceiling, but it's just sometimes was super quiet.
Now, I think that you are always exposed. That's also one thing. Yeah. Even if you have no position, you are exposed. Because your exposure then is you have nothing on. And the market is always moving. So when you have nothing on and something moves, people will ask you, why do you have nothing on, right? No, but the nice thing about the job is to have these in-depth, really in-depth discussions. And yeah, you translate them to your own exposure, but you also translate them to the firm, right? And you try to look further out. Now, what I found very interesting, Stefan, what you said, and I think that is something that is happening right now, and that is markets always overshoot.
Yes.
Now, what does it mean?
I thought you were asking a question. You're going to explain.
No, I tried to. If there are several commodities or other asset classes which have made huge moves, what you often have is that when the move gets really traction, another narrative starts to show up explaining why it is there, right? So it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then the challenge always is, what do you do? Do you hop on the wave? Or, as Stefan also said, do you see that the real opportunity then becomes being the contrarian?
Go the opposite direction.
Yeah.
But is it overshooting? What's overshooting listening?
Overshooting, at the end of the day, especially you try to look at markets as this is the price on the screen. Given all the information that we have, what is fair value? I mean, the purpose of markets is establishing fair value, and the purpose of commodity markets is to sustain a balance between supply and demand. And so a structural oversupply cannot sustain, and a structural undersupply deficit cannot sustain either. Yeah. So you look at the screen and you say, given all the information that I have, where do prices need to go to get a balance between supply and demand? With equities, it's different because you do not have basically a fixed supply in essence. And you have, for example, now in AI, although maybe in 5 years' time, we can say, look, this has created a huge amount of efficiencies, productivity growth, and has fueled GDP growth. At the moment, if you look at the stock at NVIDIA, that looks like an exponential thing that only can go up.
Bubbly.
Yeah, that looks bubbly. But are you really going to short NVIDIA now against that is getting sense from
in front
of a steamroller, right? Now, then what I find interesting about systematics and technical analysis, what I always found difficult is you can discover a trend, but the trend reversal is extremely difficult. How, Stefan, how do you look at that? And also, so being so much focused on technical analysis and systematics and being really good at it, how do you deal with, then the importance of the knowledge from a fundamental market?
Yeah.
Which I have experienced often, that we had a huge spec positioning and that we knew as a fundamental player, okay, the origin is now going to come in the market and place a huge amount of hedges. The consumer is already gone. So you can look at the chart and it looks all fantastic, but you just know from the fundamentals, the demand is gone. And without the spec continuing to buy and throw hard dollars at it, this market is going to trade down in the void, right? And this is one of the things why I usually struggled with technical analysis in markets where the fundamentals are so important in terms of order flow. Mm-hmm. How do you look at that, Stefan?
I think at the end of the day, as traders, we're paid to make decisions and have a position. And I think how I deal with it is that we have built out over the years there as well a template of trading process. And what we're discussing here is coming up with a view if it's the moment to sell. And then how do I deal with it? Well, what I worked out and part of my job at ETG and in previous lives is I did a lot of trading coaching and mentoring to people, and I do that still a lot. And I found that what is interesting to do is in the trading process is to separate into steps, intellectual steps. So the first step would be what are the analytics, and then you line up. So taking exactly your example, Martin, to get to the point where I say, okay, I know that on the S&D side, I have to turn bearish here. The market is a price level that is not sustainable. I know that the macro right now is neutral, not bullish, not bearish for globally. But of course, the charts still look very explosive, and there is this, what will the CTAs do? What will those technical guys do? But I look at the overall picture and say, okay, there will be an asymmetrical outcome. Maybe the market pushes a bit higher, but if it reverses, it will mean revert to a fair value. So that's my first step. But that is not a trade, right? That's a first mapping through analytics to come to a probabilistic view. And then I said, okay, well, let's separate. The next step is separated from the first step. And the next step is tactically, how do I turn that into a trade? And there you can address it through technicals. And there's maybe one insight that I've been very lucky to get very young in my life. Again, I've been reading a lot of books. I think I have around 150 books on trading in my bibliothèque.
See a few behind you.
Bibliothèque. There are a few of them are behind me right here, indeed. And one of the greatest books I came across was the work of the great French mathematician, the inventor of the fractal geometry, Benoît Mandelbrot. Benoît Mandelbrot invented the geometry, non-linear geometry. And he actually, his discovery, mathematical discovery, he actually used series prices of cotton with all the data as well to come up with this geometry. And there is this fantastic book called Misbehavior of Markets by Benoît Mandelbrot that explains the fractal nature of markets. So what is fractal nature of markets? And that is the one of, but we could do multiple podcasts just on this topic, actually. The whole theory of options and the reasons why we had the great financial crisis in 2008 and many other issues in financial markets is the belief that markets have a normal distribution, like the weight and height of human beings, for example. You will never see any human beings being 10 meters tall and one being 10 centimeters tall, right? There is a normal distribution. In markets have this idea, and that addresses your question about overshooting, that sometimes, theoretically, if it would be a normal distribution, you cannot have more than 3 standard deviation in more than 3 days per year. Now, it happens that in markets, you tend to have 10 standard deviation 3 or 4 times per year, and sometimes 50 standard deviation. It overshoots the tails. And so this fractal geometry, that was a great insight for me. That's for this second step of decision-making. So, okay, now, can I find a spot where we are at the tail end and I can work on a mean reversion? So that's one thing. The second thing, and that's fascinating for us in the commodity space, and I've been managing a lot of physical traders for many years at Louis Dreyfus, and one of my most enjoyable, actually, part of my career was to manage physical books, not myself directly, but the traders. And you realize that sometimes in the physical market, the market is so boring. Nothing happens at all. You feel that it's so slow. One day lasts like a week. And then you have days. In one day, more happens than the previous 3 weeks together. So time, we know as traders that time is not fixed. Time accelerates and slows down. And Benoît Mandelbrot has demonstrated that mathematically to markets. So that gave me an idea, say, hang on. So to answer your question, that trade would be a trade that maybe you struggled because you were only looking at daily charts. If you're there, up there, well, logically, what you need to do is look at a 1 hour chart. And that 1 hour chart, when it starts to reverse, will be a great trend. You just wait for that 1 hour chart. And that is the inside of time not being fixed. And that again addresses very interesting topics, the difference between different commodity classes and markets. Some markets are very trendy on a monthly chart. Equities, look at the Dow Jones chart over monthly, it's beautiful trends. Now look at the daily chart of Dow Jones and it's very noisy. It's exact opposite, or not exact opposite, but very different from a commodity, where, because commodities tend to be mean reverting long-term. They don't really have trends long-term as such. But short-term, you can have beautiful trends. So this insight about temporality is your second step of decision-making. Now, this fading a big explosion like cocoa, say you want to be bearish cocoa right now, which I'm not sure is a good idea, but you want to be a cocoa short right now, you wouldn't do it on a daily chart or weekly chart. You would do it on a 1 hour chart once it turns down. So that's the second step. The third step is that for us, at the end of the day, and all your previous guests were highlighting, for all of us, it's about survival. It's risk management. It's, okay, what happens if I'm wrong on the assumption that the market turns? Well, whatever the volatility, at the end of the day, we take decisions on money, on risk. If the market is very volatile, the size of a position is lower, as simple as that, right? And you schedule your position, your decision to take a loss at a bigger distance because the market is so volatile, but that implies that your size of your position will be smaller. That's the third step. It's risk management. How do you address the risk? And then if you push it a bit in a more complexity, you can say, well, I don't only have one type of traders trading that asset. I have some quants, I have some fundamental value traders, I have some short-term technical traders, some short-term mean reversion traders. And then you can have a further leg, a further step into that process, portfolio management, if you oversee the whole business. Say, okay, I know that some of those guys will do well in a reversal, and I know that some others will not do well. So how do I make sure that the guys that have different trading personalities capture that portfolio management? So I think if you do it through those steps, from picture that is really overwhelming, you cut them down in processes very specific. So that would be the answer.
And thank you very much for this, Stefan. I have a fun question. Can you tell me about a very good or a very bad trade that you've done? I always like that one. If you can still recall, I don't know. You've been managing already for some time.
Yeah, I think bad trades, I have too many to remember them. And I did so many bad trades in my life. And thanks God I did them, because that's the way for me to learn and to build on a process. And it's been a journey. It's been a fascinating journey to learn who you are and what is type of markets and strategies is fitting your trading style, and how do you fine-tune and hone that skill. So bad trade as such, I think, for me, what is a bad trade? So the question is first, what is a bad trade? A bad trade for me at this stage of my career is a trade where you don't respect your process.
Yeah.
That's a bad trade. You don't respect the process. And the process is, you have your analytics, they need to be deep and clear and structured. You need to have your ability to turn this analytics into a trade, the tactical implementation, choosing the right approach. Is it a spread? Is it through options? Is it through a flat position? Is it a mean reversion? Are you trading a trend? You know, what is the tactics you use? Which temporality, what we just discussed? And then, are you sizing that trade correctly? And then, is it a logical trade within your portfolio? So a bad trade for me is a trade where I don't respect the process. And that may sound very arrogant, what I will say, but I haven't done a bad trade for a long time. That doesn't mean that my trading results are good necessarily all the time, because that's another topic. And I think another book that influenced me a lot is a book by psychology. She's a PhD in psychology, and she was a great professional poker player. And she's actually today...
Counting cards.
No. It's decision making. Her name is Annie Duke. She wrote a fantastic book called Thinking in Bets. And it's about decision making. Can you separate the quality of your assessment of your trade? Can you separate the outcome from the process? The outcome, honestly, there is a randomness in the outcome of a trade. Yeah. Now, the process, you can measure the quality of the process. So a bad trade, when I was younger, I was doing so many bad trades, not being respectful of risk, jumping the gun too fast, being emotional, being stubborn in a view. Honestly, I think I did all the mistakes you can imagine as a trader. And it's been a process to learn out of that. So bad trades, now, good trades... For me, the best memories I have of good trades are more on the... There are two. Most of them are on the physical side. When I was running Louis Dreyfus in Spain, we did some very exciting stuff. We did with my partner, and he's still with us now at ETG, and he was co-MD at Louis Dreyfus, Fernando Barreiro, who's one of the best physical traders I've ever met. And we were co-MDs at Louis Dreyfus. And I remember we did the first ever Brazilian corn import into Germany, into Oldenburg. Nobody was expecting to get this big Brazilian corn ship discharged in, I don't remember if it was Hanover or where, and then going down the barges. I did other stuff like Louis Dreyfus was not trading at all tapioca. So we don't trade that anymore. But 20 years ago, manioc, tapioca, was used as a substitute to barley to feed poultry with soy meal. Louis Dreyfus didn't trade at all. We literally created that business, and we came to trade up to 1 million ton per year into Spain. And our competitive edge was that and it was creating from scratch a business, but with an edge compared to our competition. We understood, because it had very strong analytical power in Louis Dreyfus on the animal feeding side, understanding that manioc has a very direct logical component with barley. And that in Spain is a big barley producer locally, and that you can actually trade manioc with soy meal as the equivalent of barley. So we were hedging tapioca with barley plus soy meal, and nobody else was doing that. And that created an edge. So those are great memories.
That's really nice.
And then I guess as one of my best trade was getting the view on a market totally wrong. And that was the euro. I was very bullish the euro in 2000. I remember, well, autumn 2015 or 16, I don't remember. And I was very bullish the euro. And then the euro crashed by 12%. And 1 month later, people that I was voicing how bullish I was were very concerned. That was a big loss for the firm that I was running back then, Invivo. And actually, we made money out of that trade, out of trading discipline. So my longs on the different temporalities that were wrong were stopped out. But the shorts that I took as a reversal when I started doubting the market, hold on. And we turned, and then I started to intellectually understand why I was wrong in my assumption, because I was making money being short, even though I was bullish. And that changed what I think, Martin, you mentioned. Price sometimes change the rationale of the market.
Yeah.
And that's why I respect price a lot as well, because you can think whatever you want of your analytics. You think you have everything under control. But if the market does something different, no. As a trader, this is a feedback, right? Yeah. And you need to respect that.
Yeah. Very good examples. And look, related to this, I would like to use a term which is important not only for professionals, but maybe even more important for retail traders or investors, which is FOMO, fear of missing out. And the thing is, on the professional side, when certain asset classes are making huge moves and you're not in it, you get FOMO, or your client is asking, hey, why are we not in this specific asset class? Okay. Yeah. Now, and nowadays also with social media, there is a huge focus on price and not, yeah, in my mind, on process. Yeah. So I recall seeing a great presentation from Peter Lynch. And Peter Lynch was one of the most successful fund managers at the time at Fidelity. And he said that he asked some people for their reasons to buy a certain stock. And he said, look, if you say the sucker is going up, that's not a good reason. But I'm telling you, a lot of people nowadays, they buy things or individual stocks, whether it's the Magnificent Seven or maybe the S&P 500 index, they buy it because it is going up, and it's going up so strongly. And if you look at last year, for example, the overall environment was extremely bearish. And a lot of big names have been negative. But as long as the market, the price continues to go up, yeah, it becomes extremely difficult to resist that. And to also say, well, okay, my analysis is good, but the price is wrong, right? And here we are, 3 months into 24, and everything is going through the roof, right?
Yep.
So I'm thinking there is too much focus on price rather than process. And that was also one of the reasons why I wanted to start the podcast with Alex, because we like to discuss fundamentals and macros, and a much deeper analysis than just the price is moving in a certain direction.
Not sure.
Yeah. One of the best examples for me personally, it was not that long ago, that was Bill Ackman, a great investor, trader, who had a huge position on Netflix. And then only weeks after that he had that position on and also marketed it, he went out and he took a $400 million loss. And online, a lot of jokes were made about him, about what a shit trade it was. And I actually thought, well, the way he explained it in very detailed way, in essence, it came down to, well, that stock didn't meet their investment principles. That was enough for him, not the price. The driver was, so he took an informed decision for him. So I thought, well, this is a great example of someone who doesn't care about the price. He doesn't care about that short-term loss. He simply has an asset in his book now, which doesn't fit the investment principles anymore of his fund. And that's an informed decision with the long-term in mind. And I think nowadays there is so much focus on price, and that's the only thing you need to hop onto, and you need to look at a chart, and the trend is your friend. But a lot of people are in these things without any process. And when things go well, that's easy. But the doubt obviously starts when things are reversing. Yeah, so I find that very well explained.
And I think it has happened very often in the past. This is not the first time, right? You had the same mechanism during the dot-com bubble. You had the same mechanism in the roaring 20s.
Yeah.
And this is human nature. And I think one thing that is interesting in our job is that you realize that human nature doesn't change. And as a trader, you need to accept it. And you can make the most rational analysis, but you have to respect human nature. And if you start to understand how human nature works, you actually can make it a benefit for your trading decision. It's quite something that is a big driver of markets and will always be, I think. And it's one of the edge, I guess, we develop with experience as well as traders. When we're young, we are so confident about our abilities and we believe that we are smarter than the average, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know what? Maybe I'm not that smart and I don't understand that much. And even if I would do, if the behavior, the mass behavior goes against me, I will still be wrong. So what is my process to address that?
I think it's all very interesting. And I actually have still a lot of questions I would love to ask you about. How do you manage people? How do you manage your desk? How do you manage all kind of different commodities in one commodity and also globally? But also we have to consider the time. And now I think we come to the end. So I think maybe some people we have to invite again and again and again just to keep on asking all the interesting questions. And here I learned a lot. I heard a lot. And also I think, yeah, what you say about the process as well. When I was trading, I actually, what are the real processes, the steps, etc. I didn't have that. And like you say, I think price is mainly an outcome of what happens in a market. And therefore, I think a process is super important. So that's a very good learning as well. And the golden years, well explained. So now every trader can only have great years ahead.
I don't know if it will be great years, but it will make our space very attractive.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for your great explanations, your ideas, your answers. Very inspirational. And I enjoyed a lot this one time.
Yeah, Stefan, thanks from my side as well. It's fantastic. I definitely think if you're up for it, that we should invite you again, because there's just too much. There's too much depth, knowledge, super interesting topic that I'm interested to hear your view. So please consider.
Also what you said, there's three elements, right? So you said how you, your background of the technical, then freight, the fundamental part, so all came together. So I think there's so much to discuss. Yeah.
Yeah. But
happy.
Let me finish with the final
question. Oh, yeah, you go for it, man.
No, because there's one question that we always ask, because we have lots of young people listening who want to break into the commodities industry. I think this conversation today is a great example of what you want to have on a trading desk. If you do not have this, think about it. Are you on the right desk? Yeah? Now, there's one thing, but the question that we always have is, what advice do you give to young aspiring traders to enter our fascinating commodity industry?
I think that's a great question to end with.
I think being driven and being attracted to our space for the right reasons. And our space is trading in general, but commodities in particular, requires a lot of stamina, a lot of persistence and hard work, patience. It takes time to build yourself out, really know what you do. So having a view that this is your calling in life, not because it's funky or because you can make big money, but it's, I think, one of the jobs where you can learn the most about yourself and about others, the team spirit, as well having an approach of understanding that nobody has the golden goose or golden ball, and this very dynamic interaction. And so joining for the right reason with a view of a long-term build out and being persistent and driven by the process.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Thanks, end to
Stefan.
The podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot,
Stefan. Thanks again.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Stefan.
Thank you, guys.
Have a great
meeting.
Thanks
bye-bye.
A lot.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.